Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Heather Reads the Podcast. I am your host, Heather, and today we are getting pulled back into the sinister crimes in Cold Case, Colorado. Before we start, I'm going to give that same disclaimer again. There are descriptions of violence, brutality, as well as discussions about depression and suicide. If these are subjects that may upset or distress you, maybe sit today out. I promise to be back next time with something lighter. Also, this is part two of our explorations of Cold Case Colorado, so if you want to get caught up, be sure to listen to the previous episode. Even so, this book is so twisty and basically an info dump disguised as a novel, I'll go ahead and start with a basic refresher of some characters of our overall setting. Our heroine is Vanessa Whitman. She's a former high school teacher obsessed with making lists who has basically run into homelessness thanks to her father's careless money management while he was dying from colon cancer. She's currently living in the Whitman family estate, both to escape a stalker she picked up back in Denver and to help ghostwrite her uncle's memoir. And her uncle is Simon Markham, an incredibly famous and successful celebrity chef. He has been described as hot-headed as well as narcissistic. Eccentric and wild as he is, he didn't hesitate to help out Vanessa when she reached out. They had been previously separated because of an estrangement between Vanessa's father and Simon's wife, Dorothy Whitman Markham. She is the Whitman descendant as far as family goes. We don't know why she and her brother fell out, but it was bad enough that Vanessa didn't have any contact with her beloved aunt and wasn't around when Dorothy disappeared 12 years ago and declared dead when her remains were finally discovered. There's been some issue with her will, however, since Dorothy's estate has been a topic of an intense interest with Bethany Whitman Burke, a distant cousin of the Whitman family, though I'm not exactly sure where the family tree branches out with her. We don't really know much about Bethany other than the fact that it was well known that she was cheating on her husband, mostly because when she locked herself in Simon's room, screaming about getting millions, she was beamed in the head with a blunt object. The news of her murder was distressing to all guests in the house, but devastating for Lowell Burke, Bethany's husband and a real estate lawyer. The narrative seems to be trying to make him as slimy as possible, when the guy is really just freaking out about the fact that his wife was just murdered. He and Bethany had been living at the Whitman estate for a while, as they had been doing some business with a couple of folks local to Aspen, including Keith Gable. Keith is Simon's business partner in the restaurant business. Simon runs the more upscale Simplicity, while Keith runs the franchise side, Simple Simon's. He's been helping to prepare the dinner party that gathered everyone at the Whitman Castle, including Ty Coleman, the local county sheriff. His jurisdiction is a rather sleepy one, with a zero homicide rate. Ty's biggest cases usually involve search and rescue efforts, since I suppose people are too busy getting lost in the mountains to get murdered. Vanessa invited him to the castle since she would be working with him and his office to get records for Simon's memoir. Ty and Vanessa were touring the castle when Bethany was murdered, and they're the only two individuals who can claim to be completely innocent. Obviously, the big setup here is Bethany's murder, which is confounded by being a locked room case. Somehow, someone had gotten into Simon's room, killed her, and left, all while the door had been locked from the inside by Bethany herself. Ty enlists Vanessa's help to help gather information from all the suspects, which I ranted about enough in the last episode, so I'm going to leave it. As Vanessa settles into bed that night, she discovers that her stalker had managed to follow her from Denver to Aspen. As she and Ty head out into the dead of night to chase him down, Vanessa decides it's the perfect time to plant a kiss on Ty's lips. And now we pick up the next morning. Ty is sitting by the pool, watching the sunrise, when Vanessa brings him a coffee. He discusses what they found in her room that night, some small speakers that had made the noises that alerted Vanessa to her stalker. While they had been chasing the stalker, they saw the light go on in Dorothy's old sewing room. I'm only touching on this point because Vanessa had explicitly stated that her room had been locked for 12 years, and that no one has been inside since. Except now, we are being told that Mona, the housekeeper, has gone in there once a week to dust and clean. So that's not exactly being locked up for 12 years now, is it? and it was Ty who had gotten that information, not Vanessa, who has been living in the castle for the last 4 months. She never once saw Mona go to that corner of the house. It probably feels like I'm making a mountain out of a molehill here, but I'm telling you, when I read this new development, it sent me into a tizzy, the likes of which I haven't seen in myself in almost 10 years. It takes a lot for me to get worked up with small details like that, and boy oh boy, this book brought me there in no time flat. Anyway, Vanessa asks if Ty and his deputies had searched the sewing room for clues about the stalker, where he tells us that no, he hasn't. Because of his aforementioned lack of training, he's handed over the case to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, so he was waiting for their arrival to search both the murder scene and the sewing room. Vanessa and Ty head to breakfast, where they meet a CBI field agent, Jack Jenkins. He's been sent ahead to begin preliminary procedures, like taking care of the body and taking DNA samples. He calls it grunt work, but at least we don't have total amateurs on the scene, Ty. Among those samples, he's also acquired fingerprints from all the suspects, including the house and kitchen staff. There's some priors there, very minor stuff, but not unexpected. Look, if you've got an entire team of kitchen staff and they don't have at least 5 minor offenses between them, you need better kitchen staff. Trust me. As they discuss current collected evidence, Ty takes some time to enjoy the only kind of breakfast that could exist in the kitchen of a celebrity chef. Ty dropped his questioning when Mona returned to the table with a plate of 2 perfectly brown waffles, each topped with a glob of melting butter. She placed a tiny pitcher of syrup beside the plate and said something. He couldn't hear her words. His entire consciousness was consumed with the sight and smell of breakfast. As he poured the golden syrup, his mouth filled with saliva. His first bite was nearly as good as an orgasm. His eyes rolled back into his head and he moaned in sensory delight. When he opened his eyes, he saw Vanessa walking towards them. Her honey-colored curls were pulled back in a no-nonsense ponytail. She had rolled up the sleeves of her white Oxford cloth shirt as though she were ready to work. Her jeans hugged her bottom. Nice. Okay. Anyway, after Ty finishes up his waffles, Agent Morris with the CBI has arrived and set up their base of operations from inside the conference room. Ty shakes hands with Morris and suspects that Morris might feel threatened by him for some reason. Vanessa's already handed over her recordings and notes from her interviews, and Morris believes what most of the guests were saying, that Bethany was murdered because of her infidelity. Vanessa's quick to call him out for victim blaming Bethany, and Morris backs off. He does mention he wants to use the recording setup she made in the library, and she all but bites his head off, because that's how we want to cooperate with CBI investigators. Oh, and about the bit where Morris supposedly blames Bethany for her own murder, and Vanessa shutting him down? There's lots of these little moments where you can imagine Vanessa pumping her fist in the air and crying out, "Girl boss!" Obviously, the author is trying to connect with women who have a strong feminist background, but to me, it feels performative. You know, kind of like jokes. If you have to explain it, it wasn't a very good joke. Just telling me that Vanessa is a feminist isn't enough. You need to show it through her actions. Remember Show Don't Tell from She Dreamed of a Cowboy? This is the same principle. If we take a moment to compare Skylar from that novel with Vanessa, we can see a stark contrast. Vanessa has to keep telling us she's a feminist, and while Skylar doesn't even touch on the subject, she may not even define herself as a feminist. What Skylar does is ensure that she is treated no different from any other ranch hand, femininity or lung cancer be damned. And when her father falls ill, she takes no time in covering his mechanics garage, a very male-dominated industry. She works hard and puts off her own happy ending until she's satisfied that things will be all right without her. Vanessa, meanwhile, has to make a point that just because she's a woman, no one should count her out. But she makes stupid decisions, like running out in the middle of the night without a weapon to track down a stalker. The only reason she did that was because she knew Ty would be with her, therefore assuming he'd use his own theoretical masculinity to protect her. I'm not saying that Vanessa couldn't have handled the situation on her own. I'm saying that this so-called feminist is not making much sense. And you can have all the hashtag girl boss moments you want in your novel, but it's all thrown out the window when you bash a male character for participating in a traditionally feminine interest, such as when Ty sneers at Lowell for wearing makeup. That's not feminism. That's demanding gender roles be strictly segregated while propping up a woman who carries pepper spray sometimes. This book is giving me lots of feelings, and I don't like it. Moving on. They discuss that potentially the murderer, Vanessa's stalker, and Dorothy are all connected somehow. Ty thinks that Morris is trying to show him up somehow, which is laughable because Ty came in with all intents to pass leadership of the case to Morris. Maybe we're trying to carve Ty into that alpha hero slot that's all the rage these days. Ty also does not hand over the locket that was found in Bethany's hand when her body was discovered. So not only did he disturb a hot crime scene, Ty is now actively obstructing justice by withholding evidence. Fantastic! Anyway, since all the guests from the dinner party had been forbidden to leave the castle until Agent Morris was able to talk to them, Vanessa joined some of the gals for a gal pal lunch. I mean, some of the guys are there too, but they're talking about things like juice cleanses and fashion. But finally, Macy admits that it's weird to eat when one of them could be a potential murderer. Jenkins tries to calm their fears, telling them that the perp could have come and gone through some other entrance, and that they should all leave the crime solving to the professionals. Vanessa becomes more resolved to figure out what really happened and why it's tied to her aunt's disappearance. She prepares for another recording session with Simon, and after a long discussion about his grandmother and Neapolitan pizza, she ends their session by asking about Dorothy off the record. So far, it matches with what we know about the incident. One day in November, she took a horse ride and failed to come home. Search and rescue couldn't recover her until spring, where they found her remains, and investigations revealed blunt force trauma to the head. Vanessa thinks that it might be a connection with Bethany, but any writer could tell you that a fall can absolutely end with blunt force trauma, and that's why it's imperative to wear a helmet. If Dorothy forewent her helmet for all her rides, then there wouldn't have been cause for suspicion. But then we get a bomb dropped on us. Simon reveals that he and Dorothy had been going through a rough patch in their marriage. Dorothy had been against the idea of that franchise, Simple Simons, and they were already losing money from Simplicity. According to Simon, she hadn't fallen from the horse. She killed herself. Later that night, Vanessa relays this information to Ty, appropriately reeling from the news. It seems like a cut-and-dried case on the surface, but there are still some things that are still suspicious. First of all, there'd been no note. Second of all, if it had been simply suicide, why would the stalker have been interested in Dorothy's sewing room? And did Dorothy have an insurance policy? If she did, suicides tend to negate payouts, so there may have been a reason to falsify her death in order to cut Simon out of his inheritance. They decide to investigate Dorothy's sewing room for clues on their own, once Morris's team had done their preliminary search. They uncover a couple of things, starting with gowns that Dorothy had been working on for future engagements. Ty begins to wonder if Dorothy's supposed depression was potentially genetic, and asks Vanessa if she's ever considered killing herself. And reading this is just... well... She glared at him. You might think that because we live in a castle, the Whitman family is too rich and entitled to deal with real life, but you'd be wrong. I come from generations of strong women and men who made their way in the West when everything was against them. We don't quit, and we don't give up. After that stunningly insulting disregard of how depression actually works, Vanessa reveals a safe that she hoped contains documents as well as Dorothy's handgun. I mean, it is Colorado. No idea why Dorothy would keep a gun in the sewing room, though. The safe holds some gems that Dorothy used to flex on the locals, as well as the gun. It's a puzzle for the two of them, since if Dorothy did indeed kill herself, she would have used her own weapon, wouldn't she? They place the safe and its contents back where it was. Supposedly, no one else ever knew about the safe except Vanessa, and they continue to search the room. All over, they find signs of future plans that Dorothy was working on right before her disappearance. They insist that looking ahead negates any concept of Dorothy being suicidally depressed, but they keep looking. Then they come across a photo of Dorothy and Vanessa's father as children, standing next to the grave of their cat, Fluffball. Randomly, Vanessa decides that this would be the place to spread more of her father's ashes. The next morning, Ty and Morris converse over breakfast, and they discuss what forensics have concluded with Bethany's murder, that it took two blows to kill her, that there weren't any drugs in her system, and that the killer was likely right-handed. Morris is also solidly convinced that her affair was certainly the motive, and the information he has been able to dig up leads him toward either Keith Gable or Yuri Kirov. Morris also found out that Ty and Vanessa were poking around Dorothy's sewing room. Ty presented the evidence that they uncovered yesterday, but Morris is not convinced that Dorothy's death is at all related to Bethany's murder. At any rate, Morris and half his team were staying at the castle to continue investigations, and the dinner guests were allowed to leave, so long as they remained accessible. Ty accepts that Morris is really trying to do the best job that he can, and decides to distract Vanessa from all the nonsense with a horse ride. Yeah, just as an aside, everybody involved here rides horses. Before the ride, though, Vanessa has an appointment with Simon and Keith to discuss their partnership for the memoir. They talk about the franchise, about how to make hot dogs high class, and how the women in their lives could pack tons of food away without gaining an ounce. Lucky them. After the meeting, Vanessa heads out to the barn where she meets up with Ty and the horses they're going to ride. Apart from the excuse to go outside, Ty apparently had the idea to track Dorothy's last ride as best as search and rescue could figure out and record. But even though they're out investigating a dark and tragic event, Ty can't help but feel happy and at ease as he rides along the trail with Vanessa. They have some fun and even a little race, and then get back into the topic of death and murder motives. This has been my big issue so far. Obviously, there's a written attraction between Ty and Vanessa, but it's basically a sidecar attached to the giant motorcycle of a murder mystery. I can't fathom having any kind of attraction to any stranger I've only just met when I'm dealing with a murderer in the family, and possibly a suicide that may actually be a murder too. And we keep getting dunked with more and more information. I haven't even begun to explain the nonsense about Fluffball's grave, for instance. I won't lie, dear listener, it has been a huge challenge to reconcile all of this, and I am struggling. So Vanessa and Ty follow along what search and rescue believe to be Dorothy's path, including a moment where they believe she got off her horse. I'm not a tracking expert, but I really can't fathom how they could parse out her path, considering the fact that she wasn't found for months after her accident. And this whole time, as they're trying to piece together their evidence, Vanessa has got a "I'm a Whitman" thing going on in her head, as if that connection alone is enough to discredit DNA evidence. And Ty is convincing himself that he doesn't believe in psychics, but Vanessa clearly has a special connection to her long-dead aunt. Honestly, at this point, I was half expecting Dorothy to pop back into existence at the end of the novel and yell, "You've done it! You've solved the riddle!" And everyone lived happily ever after. That doesn't happen, so don't get your hopes up. But yeah, they're tracking what seems to be a well-examined path by search and rescue, following solid notes made by the team that eventually found Dorothy. But then Ty and Vanessa discuss how weather not only prevented the teams from finding her, but also how it erased any trail they could have followed. And how they eventually found what was left of her remains, there wasn't any other evidence. How is any of this making sense? I must be missing something. I must be. But all of this goes to the wayside when, as they're looking around a place called, and I swear I am not lying, Rattlesnake Ridge, one of the horses alerts Ty to a gunman in the distance. The bad guy gets a shot in before Ty can, despite his picture-perfect shooting stance, and Vanessa takes a shot in the arm. Oh, now we've finally got some good action going on. They dodge more gunfire, and Ty tosses his phone to Vanessa so she can call for backup. When it looks like the gunman is making a run for it, Ty tries to follow him, but Vanessa complicates matters. Anger flared inside her and burned off her fear and confusion. All of her second guessing was moot. She couldn't believe that Ty would just take off and leave her here at the mercy of a killer. "Aren't your deputies supposed to arrive in a few minutes?" "We're wasting time," he said. "I won't leave if you need me." She refused to play the role of wimpy damsel in distress. "I'll come with you." He looked shocked and surprised. The expression on his face was almost worth the risk she intended to take. Moving stiffly, she stood and dusted the front of her jeans. About 100 yards away, she saw Coco and Ty Stallion munching on the dull, dry grass in the meadow. When Vanessa whistled and made a clicking noise with her tongue, Coco responded. They spent enough time together that they developed their own private language. In seconds, the chestnut mare was at her side, impatiently pawing at the dust. So now, not only do we get hashtag girl boss here, we also get hashtag horse girl. As a horse girl myself, I resent being pandered to like this. They decided to hang back and wait for the deputies to arrive on the scene. Ty manages to convince Vanessa to ride back with one of the cops to the courthouse, while he and the others attempt to figure out exactly what went down. Ty is now officially convinced that someone wants Vanessa dead as well, and wants to keep her under his strict protection. So Vanessa heads to the courthouse, and I am banging my head and yelling that she needs to go to the ER for the gunshot wound. She and the deputy talk about the small town they live in, and Vanessa thinks to herself that if she had grown up in the town, she may have wanted to lay her roots down, but instead she inherited her father's need for adventure. Okay. She's led to the sheriff's office, where Ty does all his work, and they meet Gert, who is the county dispatch. Vanessa senses some hostility from her, though she really can't imagine why. But they talk about the death of Vanessa's father, and Gert pretty much says that the rest of his ashes should be buried next to Dorothy. The big problem here being is that no one knows where Dorothy is buried, so that's not weird at all. While Vanessa is sitting with Gert, who turns out to be a bit of a town gossip, which is excellent for the individual who is entrusted to be the sheriff dispatch, A-plus staffing here, she tries to get a little digging done with the opportunity. But just like any gossip, Gert demands to hear from Vanessa herself that Bethany was indeed having an affair, and if they had any idea who the guy was. Gert, if we knew that, we wouldn't be here. Vanessa tries to get more information about Dorothy's estate, which surprises Gert, since Dorothy had been using the same law firm that the Whitmans had been using for years, the Greenwell Law Firm. But Gert can tell that Vanessa's been through quite the ordeal, and orders her to take a nap on the sofa in Ty's office. Sure, we don't know if her wound has been properly treated, or if there's more than just superficial damage, but a nap'll fix her right up. Hopefully she doesn't bleed out all over the place. She wakes up for her nap, seeing that night has fallen and that Ty has returned with the horrible news that they weren't able to track down the gunman. There's some shade thrown at Morris, since if he hadn't allowed the suspects to leave the castle, Vanessa wouldn't be getting shot at. Ty also knew that she really should get her wound looked at, so he brought over Doc Ingram and his wife. He figured it would be a better option than driving all the way into Aspen for an emergency room. She and Doc chat, musing over the fact that she'd never thought she'd end up with a gunshot wound. Doc tells her that it's okay because she's a Whitman, and therefore entitled to some eccentricity. Look, eccentric is donning 11th century garb and performing music and magic at a Renaissance festival. Eccentric is getting your favorite color tattooed on your back in Japanese kanji. Eccentric is not classified as being shot at. As Doc works, Vanessa becomes more and more sure that he is not the one responsible for Bethany's murder, especially since he was pretty toasted that night and he wasn't a particularly energetic drunk. He tells her that she reminds him of Dorothy, because she's smart and pretty, of course, and that her death had hit him particularly hard. And then, as he's finishing up, their little friendly chat leads him to mentioning that he let his medical license lapse as he's stitching her up. This book is wild, I tell you what. Anyway, Doc shows her his lucky scalpel that he uses to remind himself that he used to be a doctor, and cuts the thread from her stitches with it when he's finished. Vanessa asks him to see if he knew where Dorothy might be buried, since he was the one who examined her remains, and he's surprised that she didn't know. Apparently, Dorothy's will had stipulated that her brother, Vanessa's father, determine her final resting place. But now that she's all stitched up, she's ready to get some proper sleep. But, oh no, there's a murderer on the loose, and her stalker knows where she sleeps. Where or where could she go to feel fully protected? We all know where this is going, right? They come to the stunning conclusion that she can go stay at Ty's cabin, since he can be there to protect her, show her all of the renovations he's been doing in his place. On the way there, they have this absolutely bizarre conversation about birds and nesting. Yeah, it's a metaphor, but I think the author is trying to make this deeper than it really is. Ty's been feeling some tension about his relationship to Vanessa, that they really didn't know each other. No kidding? It's been, barely 2 days since they've met? Vanessa's been seeing herself as some sort of exotic bird, and pretty much accuses Ty of being a nester, like, not generally in a bad way, but he's not fond of the comparison. It's this stuff that gets me into my tizzy frenzies. There is enough room for a short murder mystery or a fluffy romance. We can't have both. Vanessa settles into the cabin, though, admiring the work that he's already done, and using some very useful terminology, apparently. She was even able to identify a color he used as heather mist. Look, I consider myself a purple connoisseur. My name is even Heather, for Pete's sake. But I don't think I'd be able to pick out heather mist in a random line of hues if it bit me on the ankle. And I am officially convinced that this book is driving me closer to my eventual demise. Vanessa takes a shower and, of course, needs to have her bandage redone. So she and Ty settle in with some tea and start to get to know one another a little more. Ty was a nice guy, but this level of thoughtful behavior was above and beyond. He couldn't possibly have an adorable teapot with pattern of butterflies and rosebuds ready for immediate use. He must have searched his cabinets for it. He pulled out a chair for her at the table. How could this guy who played football for the Grizzlies be so sweet? Her thoughts drifted toward the memory of their kiss, which had been gentled and controlled. When they kissed again, would there be passion? She hoped so. Vanessa was ready to be swept away on an exotic adventure. Filling their teacups, adding honey, and stirring felt like an old-fashioned version of foreplay. So many Regency romances, one of her favorite choices for recreational reading, were full of repressed desire and tea drinking. She gazed at him over the rim of her cup. Could this Colorado sheriff be her modern version of Mr. Darcy? We already have way too many metaphors running around this joint. We don't need to bring Jane Austen into this mess. Ty hands her a notebook so she can indulge in her list mania and begins to prioritize their plans. First and foremost, they need to locate Dorothy's remains. And yeah, they've got to decipher a poem her father wrote about a dead cat to do it, I guess. But Search and Rescue has a drone to help out the search, so they've got that going for them. Then Vanessa needs to meet up with the lawyers at the Greenwell firm. She wants to go through paperwork and wills because this already isn't complicated enough. Ty mentions to add the fact that Morris wants to do a reenactment of the night of the murder back at the castle. I don't know anything about how forensics works, but this doesn't sound like a typical method. Whatever. Ty also finishes up with fixing her bandage, and then, finally, we start to get some real steamy action. But of course, it just drags on and on and on. His mouth joined with hers. The pressure felt just right. Not ferocious and not mushy. His lips teased. It was sensual magic. His tongue penetrated her mouth and tangled with hers. She pressed her body against his, melting into him, feeling every possible sensation. At the same time, she went into a dream state where she couldn't tell hard from soft, hot from cold, up from down. Her mention of toe curling wasn't far off the mark. His kiss made her feel like she was floating on air. It had been a long time since she'd been with a man. Were they moving too fast? She didn't want to hurt Ty or to lead him on. Vanessa was almost 30, not an easily excited teenager. She needed to be responsible. With an effort, she forced herself to separate from him. The space between them felt like an Arctic abyss. And the book just goes into more of that. This drawn-out conversation about how they don't want to hurt the other one, but some sex would be really great right now. And finally, we get something more. "I like the dark," she said.
"I can live with that."
He scooped her up off her feet and carried her the last few paces to the bed. "I don't want you to trip over something and stumble." Vanessa was a feminist, through and through, but she enjoyed being manhandled, knowing that Ty could lift her and carry her without showing any signs of exertion. In spite of his sensitivity and his dainty teapot, he was a manly man. In seconds, they were undressed. Under the crisp, cool sheets, their naked bodies curled against each other. In perfect harmony, they made love. They were good together. Too good for this to be a mistake. When I am done with this review, I am throwing this book into the nearest river. And yeah, that's all we get. From this point on, there isn't anything else that I would consider sensual or even suggestive. I'll lay it out now. They fight shortly after this. Ty starts setting stuff up in his cabin that sets off relationship alarms in Vanessa's head, and the romance cools off. It's almost as if this relationship was tacked on as an afterthought to fit a mystery peg into a romance-shaped slot. But for the rest of the novel, that's where I'm going to leave it, since there is so much else going on that trying to keep track of their tryst is just too much. The next day, Vanessa sets up an appointment for the law firm at 11, and she and Ty stop at a local diner for breakfast. The waitress gets them some more local gossip about how Simon meets with Keith there occasionally, and Lowell Burke had even met up with Doc there once. Ty is struck with awe again about how Vanessa is an official Whitman, the closest thing to Colorado had to royalty. He asks her if she knew that her family was wealthy, and, of course, dude, duh. She grew up in a freaking castle, but her past is determined to haunt her all the way through this adventure, since it seems that the lawyer they're meeting up with is a schoolmate of hers, Denny Nussbaum. When they were kids, she saw other boys jumping Denny and fought to defend him. Instead of being her friend after, he hated her for intervening, because she was a girl. Oh, this is going to be good. They do a little strategizing on trying to figure out where Dorothy was buried, using her father's poem to collect clues, but finally they leave to meet with Denny. At the firm, Ty tries to withhold judgment on Denny, but he's not particularly happy with how no one at his firm had been in contact with Vanessa with family affairs. Maybe Ty just hates lawyers. When Denny comes in, he's carrying an air of self-importance and offers condolences over the loss of Vanessa's father. He even feels guilty about letting the guy completely drain his assets. Doesn't help Vanessa now, though, does it, Denny? And he continues to reminisce, but in a judgmental sort of way that riles up Vanessa until she snaps at him that most of the assets have gone to medical treatments, and then urges him to answer the question she has. He keeps pushing her buttons, though, saying that the estrangement between Dorothy and her father included several confidential documents involving inheritance and wills, and that it may not be wise of him to reveal all that information. Vanessa is clearly agitated, and Denny gets in one more dig about how throwing punches is how Vanessa solves all her problems. She and Ty threaten to leave, but Denny decides to play ball. He reveals that Lowell Burke had been looking into what might have been inheritance rights to the castle in relation to the work that he was doing with Yuri. As due diligence, 6 months ago, Denny had begun to review documents for the inheritance case. To his knowledge, Vanessa wasn't entitled to the castle as inheritance. Ty starts putting two and two together and notes that Vanessa's stalker had started harassing her at the same time legal documents into what inheritance she was owed were being reviewed. But Denny goes on, and from what I can tell so far, the reason for the split between Dorothy and Vanessa's father was that he wanted to buy an island, and as Dorothy inherited all the tangible assets, she refused to open up that much money. You know, I'm just going to leave it. And another big bombshell was Dorothy had a life insurance policy worth $4 million, and because she killed herself, the payout had been negated. Who was the sole beneficiary, you may ask? Simon, her beloved husband? Of course not, silly. It was Vanessa! So with her head spinning from that news, and having gathered evidence that Dorothy was not intending to kill herself, Vanessa was struggling to understand why things played out like this. Because if Dorothy's suicide had been faked, more than one person was involved in the cover-up, including friendly old Doc Ingram, who had declared her cause of death. They head back to the castle to start trying to tie off loose ends. Ty wants to check in with Morris, Vanessa wants to talk to Burke, and they need to pick up the drone that they were going to use for the search for Dorothy's final resting place. At the castle, they cross paths with Mona, who drops more, "You need to hook up with that man," hints at Vanessa, which is just charming, and Keith Gable, who asks why she moved out of the castle. I don't think I'd count one night out of the castle after a grisly murder had taken place there as moving out, but who knows what goes on, it's his head. He also tells her that she needs to get away from the fairy tales and move back into the real world. He said, standing in a castle, as the head of a stupidly successful dining enterprise. Okay. Ty steers Vanessa away from that conversation, since she's getting pretty frustrated with the entire situation, and he suspects that she's close to clocking someone. They move on and meet with Morris and a forensics expert, who confirms that it was indeed blunt force trauma that did Bethany in. She's also on hand to help examine Dorothy's remains if they can find them. There's a couple of agents around as well to head up the search, and the group begins their expedition, but not before Vanessa grabs a portion of her father's ashes to scatter them in the mountains. Outside, the drone operator lays out some limitations for them, and one of the agents asks if she could one day show his daughter the drone, which then gives us another opportunity for a hashtag girl boss moment when the drone operator says, "This world needs more women in my field." I am not saying she's wrong. I'm saying we don't need this right now. Following Vanessa's instructions that she's deciphering from the dead cat poem her father wrote, they take the drone across the landscape. While they search, they also discuss suspicions that they have about whose Bethany's lover was. The top contender is currently Yuri, since it was his glove that the stalker had dropped when he showed up the night of the murder, but no one's certain yet. They find the cat's grave and make their way towards it. However, it is only a hunch that Dorothy's would be buried nearby, and they still have to look. Thanks to some crazy logic based on the locket that Bethany was holding, though, they figure out that Dorothy is basically on the opposite side of the cat's grave. They dig up the box holding her remains, and Vanessa leaves her father's ashes behind. They return to the castle, turn over Dorothy's remains to the forensic specialist, and get orders from Morris to return the next day for the reenactment of the murder. Ty and Vanessa then head out to his cabin, where they settle in for the night, and where we get our trope breakup that I have found in so many of these novels in one way or another. Vanessa accuses Ty of nesting for her, and she's not down for it. I mean, I get it. They've known each other for about only 4-ish days now, and the guy is already planning out an office for her in his house, like that's moving stupidly fast, dude, even for one of these novels. And I swear, if I ever read or hear the word nesting again, I might lose it. I would also like to take a moment to point out that we only have 10 pages left in this novel, and nothing has been resolved. We don't know the full circumstances of Dorothy's death. We don't know who the murderer is. We don't know why Bethany died, and our couple is breaking up. You can't solve all of these problems in 10 measly pages. And these aren't big George R.R. Martin pages either. They're itty bitty. Like, what the heck is happening right now? Anyway, back at the castle, they get ready for the reenactment. Everyone replays their roles more or less, and they discuss what people had been doing. Lowell and Keith get mentioned as primary suspects, since there's some motivation involving their businesses. As Ty and Vanessa do the walkthrough of their tour, they run into Martha again, and Ty asks her why she'd been crying on the night of the murder. She admits that Doc had been drinking too much and not sleeping very well. They move on and run into Lowell, who insists that he didn't know why Bethany felt entitled to anything from Dorothy's estate, and he's pretty much over the situation. I'd be too if I were in his shoes. He's being asked to play pretend when he should be at home, grieving for his wife and planning her funeral. I don't care if there was infidelity involved. They were still married. While that's going on, Vanessa gets a phone call from the forensics team and learns what we've all figured out by now. Dorothy was, in fact, dun dun dun, murdered. Gee, didn't see that coming. 4 pages left, folks. It is a race at this point. Ty and Vanessa pause in the game room, where they had found the secret passage from the beginning of the book, and wonder why Doc had reported Dorothy's death as a suicide. As they ponder this, Keith steps into the room, dragging a very distressed Doc with him. He points a gun at Vanessa and promises Ty that if he didn't disarm himself, he'd shoot her. Turns out that Doc, who had been close to Dorothy himself, was absolutely wrecked with the news of her death, and was manipulated by Keith into believing the gunshot wound in her head had been self-inflicted. But why, I was screaming, why in the heck would Keith do all of this? Because Dorothy was against Simple Simons, of course. She didn't think that it was a solid business venture, so Keith decided that the simplest way around this roadblock was to kill her. And the best guess I have for why he made it look like suicide is because he wanted to prevent the insurance payout so that no one would go sniffing any deeper into her death. Except when Lowell and that other lawyer started looking into things, he tried to scare off Vanessa by posing as her stalker. And he got all of that information by starting up an affair with Bethany, who had to die to protect his secrets. Y'all, this is a Scooby-Doo villain. I have been tugged around in cat-riddled haunted castle nonsense for a Scooby-Doo villain. God, you could almost hear Keith screeching, and I'd gotten away with it too if it weren't for that stupid sheriff and his blonde girlfriend. Oh, and what about the locked room mystery? Oh, it's totally easy. Gets tossed away with one line. He chuckled at his own cleverness. I went to the library and climbed down the wall. And I disposed of my blood-stained chef jacket in the laundry. That's it. That's the whole mystery. But now this money-grubbing psycho has Doc as a hostage, and I guess had been spreading gasoline all over the game room. Keith orders all 3 of them into the secret passage, but Doc lunges forward and shanks Keith in the leg with his lucky scalpel. Surprised by the attack, Keith fires his gun, which ignites the gas, killing both himself and Doc. So, is it normal for mystery novels to info-dump absolutely every last fact onto one page? Because that's pretty much what happened here. So, anyway, our epilogue shows up. Vanessa is now $4 million richer, plus some, since she finally got the insurance payout that she was owed with interest. And she's in California, where she's been meeting Ty to make up their relationship issues. They haven't worked out everything yet, but apparently the makeup sex is worth it anyway. Fine. And here comes Ty now, riding up the coast like the cowboy he is, asking Vanessa to marry him, literally sweeping her off her feet into the saddle. Thank God she says no, not yet, because that may have been the last linchpin keeping my sanity intact. And with that, we are done with Cold Case Colorado. And that was a ride I was not altogether happy about. So first of all, the narration was a mess. I mentioned through this entire review that it's just one big info dump from start to finish. Even the blurb on the back of the book drops a ton of lore bricks on us. I had to keep going back over and over again to check facts from past pages. That bit about the gas being ignited by Keith's gun? Aside from being stupidly unrealistic, I, for the life of me, could not find where they noted the gas in the room. I'm sure I saw it once, but it's like a damn cryptid, and I'll never see it again. If this book had been in a longer format and not shoved into the bite-sized books that Harlequin pumps out, this might have worked better if it was allowed to take its time. The setting could have had some alterations as well. I mentioned in the previous episode that a lot of the setup would have worked so much better if the story had taken place 100 years ago. The book even goes out of its way to mention historical romances. This story doesn't know what it is. Is it a cold case? A romance? A mystery murder dinner? Who knows? Cold Case Colorado sure doesn't. And honestly, Vanessa was not a likable heroine in the least. She starts up with this, oh, woe is me, poor orphan backstory, when in reality she was born with one of the most silver spoons in her mouth and comes packaged in such a performative feminist wrapping. I don't have a problem with an assertive woman who handles herself in a crisis, but if she has to shove her feminism down her throats, it feels like a justification for her behavior rather than an explanation. I've already gone down the feminism road in this review, but I wanted to touch on one more thing. I made a rather morbid joke that the first two romantic heroes we looked at this podcast all have dead women in their past, and that maybe I should keep a score. Ty doesn't have any dead women with himself, as far as I know, but a woman still had to die for this romance. Bethany was not a good person. She was cheating on her husband and trying to chase after an inheritance she had absolutely no claim to. It turns my stomach a little bit that this was the person who started this mess in the first place, because it looks bad if a pro-feminist heroine is stomping around a novel where an innocent woman was murdered. So we make the murder victim an absolute bitch, thereby lessening her loss. Some folks might say I'm stretching and that they might be right, but that's how I feel about it. And I'll be the first to admit, I'm not a fan of mystery books. They're just not my taste. But I tried to be open-minded when I approached this book. But as the novel progressed, well, you only have to listen to these reviews to track my madness. I actually looked up reviews for this book. I don't like doing this only because I don't want outside opinions to color my perception, but I had to see what others were saying, because sometimes my final opinion can be way off the mark from what others would say. Goodreads sticks this novel at an average 4 out of 5 stars from 38 ratings. If anything has made me question my response to this book, it's those stars. I might just not have been the sort of person who would like this. It obviously has fans, though. Anyway, I've said most of my piece, and I'm ready to give Heather's final score. The cover art is the highest score, a 4 out of 5. It's actually quite a dynamic look, and sets up an appropriate mood that the reader can anticipate. I'd have scored it higher, but the people in the cover look just a little bit off. Vanessa's face looks like she hasn't slept or eaten in a while, and Ty's head just looks a tad too big for his body. Nitpicks, really. Drama gets a 1 out of 5. Everything was all over the place, and in my opinion, not presented very well. It's hard to get worked up about any of the tension when we just keep getting information curveballed at us constantly. This should have been the highest rating given the genre, but the execution falls flat. Romance also gets a 1 out of 5. Harsh, I know, but this couple had zero time to really get to know each other. They are attracted to each other because the author willed it, broke up 10 pages before the end, and weren't even an official couple by the end of it. They had no time to build up any chemistry, or what little sex was in the book wasn't even lingered on. I'd have given it more slack if this had come out of the mystery section of the bookstore, but it didn't. It was right up next to all of the other romances. Realism is, you guessed it, a 1 out of 5. Like, I spent 2 episodes whinging about why this entire setup was ridiculous. I don't think I need to explain further. In the end, Cold Case Colorado is making me wonder if I should build a shelf of shame specially for books like this, the ones that make me rage and foam at the mouth. If there's someone that thinks I'm totally crazy for hating on this book, then that's fine too. My final rating is 1 insane chef murderer out of 5. That's all for today, everyone. Thanks for joining me on this bizarre murder mystery, and I do hope you'll join me again for Heather Reads, the podcast. Like the show, please visit us at heatherreads.com for more. That's heatherreads.com. If you have any questions or just want to say hi, you can email us at podcast@heatherreads.com. And remember, it doesn't matter what you read, only that it's what you love.